Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad you're with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Japan and trying to talk a little bit about contemporary Japanese politics, current events there in that country. And our guest is Scott O'Brien. He is Assistant Professor of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University. He's joining us by telephone. Questions as we talk are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. So if you're here where we are, use that number. There also is a possibility of using our toll-free line if it would be a long-distance call for you, if you're listening in and around Illinois and Indiana, wherever the signal will travel, or if you're listening in the United States on the internet, you may use our toll-free line. Either way, that's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor O'Brien, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me on the show today. I look forward to this discussion about Japan.
This is, in a sense, kind of a general question, but to start out with, you know, I think going back to the, particularly for the 1980s, when the Japanese economy was very, very strong, I'm sure that many Japanese felt a great deal of confidence in themselves, in their country, in their place in the world. Now, that was then. This is now. And we certainly Japan continues to be very important, have a very strong economy, but it's not what it was. Is it possible to say something about how Japanese people, how today they feel about themselves and about their country?
Yeah, I think that's it's a good place to start. Obviously, it's a broad question, a broad topic. There are a lot of different angles to take on it. But since so much of post-World War II Japanese sort of national identity and even individual personal identity was wrapped up in the sense of national power expressed in economic or material terms, it does make sense, as your question proposes, to think about Japan's sort of collective sense of self through the lens of economy and economic power. I mean, one thing I would say is that Japan, of course, has been an economic power really for much of the 20th century. We often sort of tell a story of Japan's rise in the post-war period, post-World War II period, and culmination in the 80s as an economic power, but really it was seen as an economic rival to the United States and other major imperial powers going well back into the early part of the 20th century. So that sort of puts in a longer perspective. But certainly by the 80s, Japan was seen both by Japanese and by people outside, you know, thinking of the U.S.-Japan relationship as a kind of, you know, operating in a kind of world-beating system. They seem to be able to do nothing wrong in terms of industrial policy, corporate strength, rising incomes, trade strength, etc. And obviously, today, we don't hear so much about those aspects of Japan, or rather, when we talk about trade power or fast growth rates, etc., we don't tend to be talking about Japan any longer, but of course, China and India most prominently. I think one way to think about what you've asked, though, is first to start in absolute terms. Japan still remains the second largest economy in the world by far. The United States is about $12 trillion economy, Japan about $5 trillion, about half as big. And many, many other countries bringing up the rear at considerably smaller sizes. So Japan remains an extremely important place, just defined in terms of, you know, the general size, or the absolute size of the economy. It also remains a rich country. It's easy to hear about economic stagnation, et cetera, in Japan, and Japan being in the doldrums or losing its way, and somehow think that all that's happened in the past, you know, over the 20th century and in the post-World War II decades of really amazing economic material wealth, growth and wealth, that's somehow all gone away, and that's simply not the case. Japan remains a wealthy country, and generally people there are well off in relative terms to certainly, you know, the countries that are still trying to accommodate to the globalization system, et cetera. Now, the other way to look at this, and this gets more to I think, the relevant part of your question, that is to talk not about absolute size or strength, but to talk about general trends. And it's clear that, you know, when we're looking at change in the near term and medium term, it's places like China and India where people have focused a lot of attention for good reason. Economic growth rates are so much vastly larger in those countries. Of course, they're starting from relatively lower positions, again, defined in terms of, you know, general size of the gross national product or per capita income, et cetera. So Japan is definitely in a relatively different position now than it used to be in the 80s in terms of the dynamics of change. Change there is now much slower, you know, in more recent years, maybe growing 1 or 2%. And we can talk about different facets of change and relative differences in change between a place like China and Japan as we go on in this discussion. But clearly all this has had an effect on Japanese national self-confidence and people's individual sense of where their place is, both in their country and in the world.
Hmm. I wonder particularly how it is that that breaks down along generational lines, and how it is that, say, you know, people in their 50s and older feel about their country as compared with, say, young people who would maybe be in their teens or early 20s.
Yeah. Well, as in many, you know, in most sort of developed, relatively rich countries, there are generational divisions that I think will sound somewhat familiar to us, although the specific national context that shape the intergenerational differences or concerns might be slightly different. But if we compare Japan, the sort of generational difference between the people in their 50s and 60s to younger generations, we might still talk about an idea, really, and I'm sort of being fanciful here in part. I've not seen anyone use this phrase, but there really is a sense of the older generation being perhaps Japan's great generation of the post-World War II period. Here we're not talking about the American idea of the generation that won World War II, of course, but the generation that won the peace, if you will, after World War II, that is to say, the generation of those who put their noses to the grindstone in corporate Japan and in entrepreneurial Japan and small companies all throughout that country, rebuilt after massive devastation after the war, and brought Japan into a period of massive increase in material wealth for many decades on end. This was not just a phenomenon of the 1980s. Japan was a place of great dynamic change from really the late 1950s all the way up into the early 1990s. So there definitely is a sense of pride among that older generation, and looking at the younger generation, a sense of these, you know, these younger people not knowing where Japan has come from, not fully appreciating what the old generation did, the sacrifices they made. And I think for the point of view of the younger generation, of course, there's the general concern that young Americans have about, you know, the world is much more competitive now, or there are many more competitive players in economic terms. What does globalization mean for, you know, me as a young Japanese person looking for a job, in the same way that young Americans might be worried about that? And, you know, probably only a very vague sense of the history going back 60 years. I mean, just in the same way that we often lament here that younger generations have a very, very small historical perspective. I think that's a very common thing in Japan.
Yeah, I was about to launch into another question, but I don't want to make sure that you were finished.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking more, I've just sort of given a critique of the younger generation, but, but I've also tried to give a sense of their worries. In another sense, I think, you know, young Japanese, and of course here I'm being extremely schematic and generalizing in large ways, but you know, in a lot of ways, their concerns are really very similar to young, you know, I'm here on a college campus, young students who are here on a campus in Bloomington, Indiana, or in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. You know, they're very much into contemporary technology and popular culture, the intersections between those things. There are many, many subcultures in Japan of young people participate in. And these are subcultures and, you know, aspects of change in popular culture, the internet and all that, that really are global phenomenon. They're not really specific to Japan. So certainly a lot of young people's energy in Japan goes in those directions, just as they do for young people here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, just very quickly, let me again reintroduce our guest, Scott O'Brien. He is Assistant Professor of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University. And we're talking about Japan, contemporary Japan. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to ask a different sort of question that that perhaps has more to do with us, with the United States, but it connects to Japan. Again, I think back to, it seems not all that long ago when we were just consumed with the threat that Japan posed economically. And, and if you think back to just how much there was about Japan in popular media in the United States,
absolutely.
Every time you turned around, and the headline was, how will we meet the Japanese challenge? We've we won the war, did we lose the peace, or all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems that it's not that there's no mention of Japan in our media, because we continue to be fascinated by the Japanese and Japanese culture, but it's not like it was. And in part, that also reflects the fact that often in politics and in media, we're consumed with one thing, and then pretty soon we're consumed with something else.
Yeah.
But what can one say now about about what Japan means for the United States? How we think about it? The importance of there being positive relationships between the two governments. I mean, what now does Japan mean to us?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that really motivates me in my teaching in college classrooms is always this question, and as a way of trying to make Japan relevant for students who might not know a lot about Japan from the beginning, is to talk about the long-term history of this kind of mutual gaze between the United States and Japan, and how that has played out over the different decades, the ups and downs of it, which you yourself in your question have just nicely kind of summarized. Sometimes there seems to be this kind of zero-sum game view, and if Japan is up, then the United States is down. And when Japan falters in some sense, for example, in growth rates or corporate power, then you can almost hear a kind of collective national sigh of relief in the United States. After all, we weren't so bad. We weren't as economically pathetic as we might have worried in the 1970s and 80s. And the Japanese don't really have it all together as we all thought they did. So everything is okay now. And again, there's a long history of that goes even before World War II. As I mentioned in the first part of our talk, real concern in very early parts of the 20th century about coming wars with Japan and Japan as an unfair trading competitor, etc. So these have long histories, these kinds of zero-sum games ways of competitive thinking, bilateral thinking between U.S. and Japan. Part of it, of course, is fueled by an incessant real cultural fascination from the United States point of view about Japan. Sometimes that fascination, is organized around pretty stereotypical images. But nevertheless, it's been there for a long time, really since the United States and Japan opened their international relations, their bilateral relations in the mid-19th century. But parts of it, of course, also are fueled by latter-day 20th century views of national power defined in economic terms. And especially, that's certainly what we saw in the 1980s. The very first book I ever read about Japan, this is when I was a high school student in the late 70s, early 80s, was Japan as Number One. That's something I'm sure you're aware of, David.
Oh, yes.
Big
yes.
bestseller, which made the most famously made the case for Japan as not just having it together in terms of economic growth rates, but dealing with social problems, the whole sort of state-society relations, and that the United States ought to be learning a lot from Japan. In the midst of the United States in the 70s, it seemed rather moribund, dealing with social disruptions, crime, falling growth rates, etc. So that really was the beginning of a real high point all across the 80s, as you point out, in increasing obsession with Japan as a potential threat. And by the late 80s and early 90s, the sense that Japan was going to buy up America and, Rockefeller Center in New York City was bought by a Japanese corporation, and the list went on and on. And at the time that I was just entering graduate school, I was collecting these, U.S. major magazine covers that were about these themes. You're right, it was everywhere you looked at the time. I think we're now in a better phase in U.S.-Japan relations. That is to say, the kind of emotional quotient has been brought down, which I think is good. And there's this much more realistic understanding that these are the two most powerful economies in the world, and flowing from that is a lot of political and cultural influence. Japan's not just an economic power, but also a cultural power in ways that maybe we can talk about in a few minutes as well. And I think, just looking in the area that we're speaking from, David, in the Midwest and also in the south of the United States, the deep economic interactions, I mean, the Japanese automobile companies putting factories in the United States beginning in the late 80s and across the 90s, it really has had an effect. And it's not just the factories building the cars themselves, but all the parts manufacturers, et cetera, and the jobs that flow from that. I think that sort of thing has really helped push against, again, the more emotional, kind of irrational nationalist, if I could say that, really American nationalist concerns about Japan. A Japanese company making cars is essentially an American company if you're looking at it from the point of view of jobs in large part these days. That was not true in the 70s and the beginning part of the 80s, so I think that's helped quite a bit. The intermeshing of the social economies is much greater than it was before, and I think that's helped.
Maybe we could talk just a little bit about Japanese politics. At least I want to give you opportunity maybe to talk a little bit about the kind of turnover that's happened in the leadership within the last couple of years. I think that Japan has now had three prime ministers in less than 2 years. Junichiro Koizumi was there from – he actually served for a number of years. He served from April 2001 until September 2006.
Yeah, actually one of the most long-serving.
So that was so we couldn't say anything about, you know, his he did have a long term there. But then succeeding him, Shinzo Abe, September 2006, he was only in there for a year, and now the prime minister is a man named Yasuo Fukuda. And obviously, Mr. Abe had a lot of problems. There were a lot of charges of against his administration of corruption. And so his approval ratings were exceedingly low. So that might indeed explain why it is that he resigned suddenly and unexpectedly after only a year. But does the fact that, there has been this rapid turnover of leadership in a relatively short period of time tell you – what exactly does that tell you?
Well, I think, you know, really I take your point. If you look really over the long term of parliamentary democracy as opposed to presidential democracy like we have in this country, there does tend to be greater turnover. I mean, you can call elections in between the prescribed election cycle of every 4 years for the Diet, for the parliament. So looking at any parliamentary system, there often is higher rates of turnover. So that's just one kind of political point in terms of comparative political systems. But, you know, in recent years, I think there is something to say about, I mean, particularly, I guess what we really need to be talking about is Abe's really disastrous year as prime minister. He came in replacing a very, very successful and extremely popular prime minister, Koizumi, very popular with the public, very kind of representing a new face in style and approach, very frank-speaking prime minister. Although there have been other prime ministers who've laid claim to that sort of stylistic approach in the past as well, but at least that's how he was advertised. And then Abe coming in with a lot of high hopes about how he will continue Koizumi's approaches and some of his attempts at reform bureaucratically and economically, and really just falling disastrously on his face for a host of reasons. I mean, a lot of this had to do with, you know, missteps on the part of Abe as a prime minister. I mean, his political sensibilities weren't very acute compared to Koizumi's, and to most other prime ministers, for that matter. So there's explaining Abe's administration. We, you know, we've yet to see how long Fukuda's going to go, and it seems that he's not falling into the same kind of pitfalls that Abe did. There is also the broader sort of political context of the change in Abe's, you know, dramatic fall, and that is, you know, a period of time in Japan politically and economically and socially where there are a lot of this sort of late industrial or even post-industrial problems of a highly developed economy that we're dealing with in the United States. Again, if I can just sort of try to make things relevant to our experience here in the States right now, we're in the middle of an election campaign here as well. And, you know, Abe sort of fell down and ran up against some of the very difficult problems that some of these administrations have been trying to respond to. Huge amounts of government debt, you know, pension programs that don't look sufficient to take care of an aging population, what is seen as sclerotic and, you know, more kind of old-fashioned bureaucratic resistance to change. And there's a whole list of things that in many ways sound at least somewhat familiar to us in the United States, but also have their own particular, you know, specificity in the Japanese context. And I think, you know, right now people are looking to see, can the government system, you know, can these administrations of the Liberal Democratic Party respond to these massively difficult problems? And Koizumi had some success. He privatized the postal system, which really an amazing victory on his part, separate from what one thinks about that as an approach to government. He came in saying he was going to do this kind of reform, and he successfully did it. Abe, however, completely unsuccessful. So it remains to be seen. Fukuda has only been in there since last fall. But these are the kind of problems that are the context of political turmoil or, you know, cabinets rising and falling when they do.
Well, I suppose any place you go, if the economy is doing well, the political leadership will try to take the credit. And if it's going badly, they're going to be blamed. And one has to ask, in fact, to what extent either the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Japan or any other leader has that much influence in the economy, either to to make it go sour or make things go well. But it sounds like there, as well as here or anyplace else, that whoever is in charge right at the moment, if things are not going well, they're going to get the blame.
Well, that's certainly true. And these kind of problems that I've been describing have, of course, long-term roots. And these kind of discussions about what can the government do, how much is it responsible for fueling, you know, an economic or more robust economic performance or creating social safety nets for an aging population, all of these kind of discussions really have been going on from the beginning of the 1990s. So these are discussions that are a decade and a half old, many of them. And, you know, the kind of long-term solutions that seem workable and seem at least generally appropriate fixes for the long-term dilemmas have been quite elusive for any of these administrations. And that goes for administrations that weren't just Liberal Democratic Party. They've been, of course, the most dominant party in Japanese politics going back into the 1950s. But there were short administrations in the 90s of other political party cabinets, and they themselves had you know, difficulties. Socialist Party cabinet at an earlier period in the 90s, et cetera. So the problem being faced in Japan, a late industrial or post-industrial economy, very complex society, aging population, increasing competition from overseas, et cetera, all these sort of socioeconomic problems, they're very difficult, they're very complex, and I agree with you, it's not clear how much any one prime minister is going to be able to fix them by him or herself. Mm-hmm. Of course, corporate power has a lot to do with this as well, and a lot of the criticism has come down on financial policy in Japan, getting rid of debt, both public and private, but also on how Japanese corporations have or have not been able to respond to increasing international competition and respond to the problems of the early 1990s when a period of a bubble economy came to an end and a lot of debt, sort of like we're dealing with now here in the subprime market, different context, but at least a rough analogy. A lot of debt was created that people had to try to wrestle with, corporations and financial institutions had to try to deal with. So there's blame and many actors in many different sectors of the both public and private parts of Japan that are participating and trying to come to solutions.
The current prime minister, the past prime minister, come from established political families.
Absolutely.
In Japan, Mr. Fukuda, who is the prime minister now, his dad was prime minister.
Yes.
Shinzo Abe's his grandfather was prime minister.
Yes.
And I wonder whether people in Japan say, you know, look at this and say, maybe part of our problem is that we have this entrenched political elite. We have the same people, in a sense, who have been making the same decisions forever and ever. And maybe it would be a good thing for Japan if we had some fresh blood in here. Some people would come in who would have some new ideas, and perhaps that would make a big difference.
That's been a very common refrain across all these election cycles in Japan, again, since the early 1990s. You know, in my very close watching of Japan began probably in those years where I really was paying attention to all the ins and outs of the politics. It's just a perennial sort of discourse that you hear. You know, what are we going to do to reinvigorate the political system? How much should old political factions and you know, and sometimes the actual individuals and the families who have been at the center of them, how much should they be able to continue? And how much are they going to be able to keep getting democratic support from the Japanese electorate? Clearly, I mean, Japan is a democracy. Let's make no, you know, there's no question about that. It's got its imperfections, as ours does. But we're not talking about a place like People's Republic of China, where there are no free, you know, and open political parties or elections. So, you know, people are electing these people. There are institutional barriers and a kind of larger structures that make it hard to sort of maybe make the kind of changes that some people wish that they could. But there have been moments of success, David, actually. If you go back to the mid-90s, again, it was a period of a lot of change and excitement in Japanese politics, and now, you know, we're going on 10 or 12 years since that period. But there was actual electoral reform in an attempt to push the Japanese political system more towards a two-party system, often talked about in Japan in the model of the United States, that sometimes part of the problem is too many political parties. We need two robust parties, not just one very, very strong party and a lot of very weak minor parties so that we can get more debate. It seemed for a time that those electoral reforms might have had some success, but once again, the LDP, the old standby dominator of the prime minister positions in Japan for decades and decades, soon enough came back by the late 1990s, still to remain really the most powerful party in the country. So there have been attempts to inject new ideas, to change the actual structures as a way of generating new ideas. But these things were, you know, large changes like this are very difficult. Another thing I would say is there's a lot of focus. You talked about fresh faces. Mm-hmm. There seems to be this perennial fascination with, you know, again, like in the United States, this is part of every kind of representative democracy, I think. How much is political change and political dynamism driven by simply the charisma of a fascinating and intelligent and able leader, and how much of it is driven by, you know, structural arrangements that are already in place? And there have been several moments. I mentioned Koizumi, the prime minister who was in place for about 5 years, very popular in the beginning in 2001, as being an example of one of these fresh face sort of individuals. And he was very popular, very articulate, very frank, really media savvy, et cetera. But he hasn't been the only one. I mean, the individual in 93, 94 who was the first prime minister not to represent the Liberal Democratic Party since the mid-1950s, Hosokawa, Prime Minister Hosokawa, also was at that time, you know, prominently advertised as a fresh face, a young generation. He was compared to Kennedy. And there are any other sort of politicians I can talk about. Often we hear in Japan about politicians being quite staid, vanilla, not having any personality. But actually, if you look back over the post-war period, my view always is that there's actually been quite a number of individuals who at the time were advertised as being frank speaking, speaking their mind, very charismatic, going all the way back to the occupation period when the United States occupied Japan. Prime Minister Yoshida Shigeru, very famous for being charismatic and outspoken. So sometimes these things are kind of stereotypes. You know, Japan never has fresh faces. Hmm. It actually has happened, but what does that really bring? I mean, these systems are very complex, as you and I have been saying, both in the United States and in Japan.
Well, certainly people said those things that you said, that people have said about some politicians going back during the post-war period. Certainly people said those kinds of things about Junichiro Koizumi.
Yes, absolutely. That's what he's really the latest example. Mm. And when I first started hearing this kind of advertisement about this prime minister, I thought, well, you know, we've heard this before, Hosokawa, and they're, you know, going back into the 80s, a very popular Nakasone, who had that very close relationship with Ronald Reagan here in the United States, the so-called Ron-Yasu bilateral relationship between these two people who claim to be great friends. And Nakasone himself, very charismatic, very strong-willed, very strong nationalist sense of, you know, Japan's place in the world, not afraid to, you know, upset other leaders around the world with his points of view. So my view when I heard about Koizumi was, okay, you know, we've heard this before, but, you know, it's quite clear Koizumi was a very charismatic guy. I mean, he, you know, rock and roll Koizumi came here to the States and, you know, loves Elvis and all that. Mm-hmm. He obviously was, he kind of struck a chord with Japanese in the way that for many Americans, not all, of course, but for many Americans, Clinton did when he first came in.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We have a couple of callers. We'll get to right to them in just a moment as soon as I introduce again our guest, Scott O'Brien. He is Assistant Professor of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University. We're talking about contemporary Japan, Japanese politics, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here. We'll start with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
I tuned in late, so I may have missed this and you might have discussed it. I'm interested in the issue of the relationship of Japan with its Asian neighbors, and specifically in terms of, let me say, the hostility that stems from World War II and the period prior to World War II, the colonization by Japan of Korea, Manchuria, and then some of the activity during World War II in Philippines and in Southeast Asia. And I bring this up in part because of my own experience in these parts of Asia, in the sense that I see that I'm a Buddhist priest, and I've seen relationships between Korean and Japanese Buddhists priests and Chinese and Japanese monastics On that level, it seems to be fine. But on a deeper level, there seems to be a tremendous hostility towards Japan for its past and for the unwillingness or inability of the Japanese culture as a whole and the Japanese society to come to grips and, if I use a word, repent or at least atone in some way that seems meaningful, and that and I see this as a potential for future conflict, economic, political, and even militarily at some point,
yes.
Especially if you throw in North Korea into the mix.
Yeah.
So I'll just let you talk about that, and I'll listen off. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Very
thank
good.
You.
Excellent,
thank you.
Excellent set of issues.
Absolutely. I mean, these are extremely large issues in any even cursory you know, sort of looking at Japan and its relationship to its Asian neighbors. Of course, it's a, you know, the set of issues and concerns that the caller is pointing to is it's the set of very controversial topics, very political, very very much at the center of you know, sort of perennially fluorescing debates and international protest in Japan and throughout East Asia, back and forth. So there's a lot to talk about there. Often these things are the kind of concerns, the World War II and colonial era history that the caller is speaking to are couched in terms of the question, and I think this was embedded in the caller's comments of Japan's apologizing for earlier actions in the modern period or not. And again, a very controversial topic. I guess I would start out by saying that there is a great deal that, you know, the Japanese society and Japanese history needs to account for in terms of its international relations and its treatment of other Asians. Japan, you know, beginning in the late 19th century, itself felt that it was under threat from other imperializing powers, from the United States and from European imperializing powers who were traveling the globe and essentially gobbling up states and societies that were weaker than they. The Japanese response was to create, within several decades of their modern revolution in 1868, the beginnings of a modern empire with a new modern nation-state at the center of it, with a revitalized, centralized state system that threw over the samurai system that had existed for many hundreds of years prior to that. So imperialized, you know, and building an empire in a modern sense became part of what, you know, the Japanese state and society as well, supporting that state, felt it needed to do to be a player in the world and to survive itself. What's interesting is, according to the rules of the day in the early part of the 20th century, and this is by no means, you know, a position that I celebrate today or would be in any kind of accord with, but just to historically relativize these things, Japan was celebrated when it colonized Korea in 1910. Celebrated by the United States and all the other imperial powers. This was seen as a legitimate move, as repugnant an idea as that it is to us today. In 1905 and 1910, Japan was seen as the proper civilizing power that ought to annex Korea and take charge of that society, help it modernize, etc. Those really were mainstream ideas at the time if you were in one of the imperial powers. Obviously, no one was asking Koreans what they felt about that. Sort of the latter issues are the World War II time frame, which really is the 1930s and first half of the 1940s. And there we're talking about increasing expansion of empire, really aggressive seizure of parts of the former empires of China, the former Qing dynasty in China, in Manchuria, as the caller points out, and then even attacking the heartland of China itself in moves that around the world were roundly denounced and criticized by the League of Nations at the time, precursor to the United Nations, and by all the other imperial powers, the United States included, and of course, the Chinese in China itself. And that really began a period of time that Japanese have, you know, had a hard time sort of coming to terms with. Then there are the sort of World War II, 1937 to 1945 era of atrocities, the rape of Nanjing, the so-called comfort women issue, where women were forced into sexual slavery, under the Japanese imperial military, the abuse of POWs, et cetera. The list goes on, and these are quite well known by anybody that pays attention to this. In some ways, and so the debate has gone, has sort of gone in this direction. You know, Japan, or the argument goes, Japan has not, unlike some place like Germany, for example, adequately accounted for those atrocities or for that earlier wartime aggressive history, nor for the colonial history going back to the early part of the 20th century and the late 19th century. Why is that so? There's a lot to untangle in that discussion. First, the premise that, Japanese have not at all come to terms with these earlier histories is one thing to consider. I think sometimes in media accounts, and again, I am not by any way defending the Japanese state, the Japanese government's responses to these issues over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, because generally they have been completely unsatisfactory, ham-handed, and completely misguided in many, many ways. But there, sometimes one gets the idea that you can't even speak about World War II or atrocities in Japan, that somehow there's, you know, censorship of these discussions, or that society has completely been silent on these for the last 60 years, and that's just not true. Japan is an open society. There are books that, detail these atrocities in Japanese, written by Japanese scholars. In fact, a lot of the data on some of these things, the Rape of Nanjing, for example, and others, were in part, not wholly, but in part, gathered by Japanese researchers and scholars, especially those on the left wing of the political spectrum who were critical of the wartime policies of the government and the imperial military. And, you know, just to throw this out there, the idea that there's been, for example, never any apology for whatever it is we're talking about Japanese should apologize for. There again, I think we need to disentangle things, perhaps. And one might say they should apologize for everything, and that's perfectly valid. But sometimes people put, you know, colonialism, war, wartime atrocity, all into one big bunch, and I think it might help sometimes to disentangle these things. But there have been some attempts to apologize. People might think they're insufficient. Generally, I would agree with that. But beginning in the 1990s in particular, and coming far too late, I would add, the cabinets in Japan, beginning with the Socialist Party Prime Minister Murayama, did officially apologize for aggression in East Asia. Here, particularly, I think what was being referred to is 1937 to 1945 aggression in World War II. And the cabinets that followed Murayama's cabinet in the mid-90s have all basically, I mean, nobody has retracted that official stance of the Japanese government. The South Korean government accepted that apology. The People's Republic of China, the party, has never accepted that as a full apology. And this remains an open wound. There's no question about that between Japan and its other neighbors. And I myself have been concerned that this is the kind of thing that could fuel not just increasing tension, perhaps even, you know, military conflict in Northeast Asia. I think right now, as we talk in the beginning of 2008, things are in a calmer footing and there's more reasoned discussion going on. There have been a lot of bilateral high-level talks and official diplomatic visits by the Japanese Prime Minister to China and the Chinese leaders to Japan in the last year and a half or so, and I think that's a very good step in the right direction.
Well, again, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Others are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest Scott O'Brien from Indiana University. We're talking about Japan and contemporary Japan. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It seems to me that one of the things that one of the issues around which there's been a lot of discussion among Japanese elites, at least for several decades now, has to do with Japan's place in the world.
Yeah.
And to what extent Japan should be involved in the world, and in what way?
Yes.
And that's complicated by a lot of things. It's complicated by the Japanese Constitution. It may indeed be complicated by economic issues. But there have been people now, I think, for, you know, maybe something like 30 years,
yes,
that have been really arguing that Japan has been much too much inwardly focused,
yeah,
and that in fact they really need to open up, be involved in the world, be a citizen of the world, and do that, and not just give lip service to that notion, but actually do it.
Yeah.
To what extent has that kind of argument, mm-hmm, taken hold, and would you say that there were important ways in which Japan really has extended itself and been involved in the world in ways that previously it had?
Yeah, no, I hear where you're coming from. There are so many ways to get at that question of Japan's involvement in the world, and Of course, the domains in which one is usually talking, about which one is usually talking when that language is used, is the domain of international relations, mm-hmm. diplomatic mm-hmm. efforts, and military, the use of the military. Really, those are the things people talk about when they talk about involvement in the world. But if I could just be, you know, to try to push out from, and I'll get back to those in a second, but I would actually start with the cultural realm. I mean, if you speak from the cultural realm, Japan is incredibly involved with the rest of the world. You know, Japanese culture, many parts of it, is part of global culture now. The Japanese soft power, if you will, or not even put in nationalistic terms, just cultural power, is, you know, it's one of the most kind of dynamic and interesting cultural producers of cultural products, if you will. I mean, the gaming and film and the manga, crazy in the United States. If it wasn't for manga, Japanese comics, in the many fascinating directions that whole area of art had gone, I wouldn't have half the students I do in my classroom. You know, half of them come in because of their interest in manga. Uh-huh. So there's, you know, Japan is part of a global system, and in many, many ways is, you know, fully integrated. And culturally, I think, is one of the most unspoken parts, and I think that is a really salutary way of looking at things, because it's kind of a normalization of Japan. Of course, students know that Japanese cultural products, the films, you know, the Japanese horror films, that people, there were sort of a wave of that in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. People know vaguely they're from Japan. Some students, some young people get excited about Japan because of that, but for many other people, it's just something that's out there that's interesting and cool. People talk about the rise of Japan's, not their gross national product, but their gross national cool, which I think is a wonderful phrase to try to get at this element of the way Japanese culture, in a contemporary sense. I'm not talking about the tea ceremony. I'm talking about, you know, early 21st century, late 20th century forms of popular culture. Japan is front and center in that. In terms of the more conventional terms in which that debate is taking place, and I think that's, you know, it's important stuff, and that your question was based on these kinds of concepts, the diplomatic and military realms. You know, I think that the long-standing distrust by East Asian and Southeast Asian neighbors of Japanese intentions, the memories of World War II and the colonial period in Japan, or in East Asia, have certainly colored for many, many decades Japan's modes of involvement and the degree to which the Japanese governments and, you know, the diplomatic parts of the Japanese government were able to or willing to take leadership roles in East Asia and Southeast Asia and even other parts of the world. I think there's no question about that. Japan also has been really a junior partner to the United States for so many decades. I mean, Japan was occupied by the United States after World War II. The treaties that emerged out of that occupation in the early 50s put Japan in a very close bilateral relationship with the United States, and really a relationship that left so much of the sort of diplomatic elements, the ways in which governments go out and try to organize other governments, try to respond to world crises, et cetera, sort of put all that in the lap of the United States. And Japan, the Japanese government's often just following the lead. I think that's often been one of the conditioning elements of the Japanese views of the world as well. In more recent years, I think there has been an attempt, again, beginning in, you know, perhaps the last 10 years or so, part of a perennial debate, again, there's been an attempt by these governments to be more assertive, to take part, for example, in more of a leadership role in the six-party talks, for example, in the North Korean problem that you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, to be a leader in various, you know, regional organizations, economic, environmental, for example. Japan out in front on global environmental change and trying to be a leader in that way. So I think the ways in which, you know, countries can express their leadership and take part in the world have sort of ramified, increased over time. And in some of them, Japan plays a quite prominent role. In others, there have been restrictions, and part of those have been historical in nature. One other thing I would mention is, you know, if you take, I know the United Nations is highly controversial. Many people in the United States think it's, you know, an institution that's outlived its usefulness, that it's corrupt, et cetera. But it has been one of the premier institutions through which, you know, world affairs have been governed over the last 60 years. And Japan now, you know, and for a long time, one of the premier, one of the largest donors to the United Nations. And in the UN setting, Japan has always played a leadership role, despite the fact that it doesn't have a permanent seat in the Security Council. So the discussion can go in a lot of different directions. hopefully that sort of suggests what some of the recent developments have been.
Well, just it makes me think about the fact that to what extent, well, first of all, to what extent that people have been critical of the United States for its failure to take advantage of the potential of soft power. But I also think about just how much has been written about Asian nations, China particularly, about the fact that it recognizes just how important soft power can be, and it certainly is. It's diplomatic, economic, cultural power. The Chinese are very deliberately moving out into the world and using those to win friends.
I think that's true. I mean, the Olympics coming up in Beijing. We just had a little symposium here on the Beijing Olympics that we tried here at Indiana University. We tried to put that in historical perspective, and there have been a number of Asian Olympics. And each one of them, the country hosting the Olympics has used that venue as a way of projecting a certain national image, as of telling a narrative of national arrival. And Beijing is, turning the volume up on that louder than anyone has been able to do so far, I think, in any of the Olympics in history. I mean, they really ratcheted up this sense of projecting an image of China and really playing it to the hilt in terms of the marketing that's going along with that. But in some ways, they're taking a page out of the Tokyo book going all the way back to the 1964 Olympics. So there have been moments when the kind of official attempt to promote soft power in Japan has had its moments of success. But a lot of what I'm talking about, I think, really is, in China it's such a different political situation where the party's in charge. In Japan, I think, I'm happy to say, when I say soft power, it really is a misnomer, because I'm really talking about the ways in which private culture, corporations making gaming products, or artists writing manga, or painters, or architects. I mean, Japanese architectural dynamism has been incredibly influential in the last 20 years. These things aren't run by the government. So this is just Japanese individuals, Japanese expressing their creative potential, and it being very successful around the world. And I think that's a big difference between China and Japan. Of course, there are national policies at certain moments to try to project certain images to promote Japanese culture. Embassies do that all around the world always. But in the Japanese case, unlike China, and I think we ought to be happy about this, it's an open society. Most of this is being done by private means, which I think is a good thing.
Just a couple of minutes left, and here I open up an area where we really don't have very much time to talk. But one other thing I just am interested in having you touch on, and that is, how much that Japan and Japanese government now here in the near term and in the future are going to have to be concerned about social issues at home, everything from dealing with poverty, which does exist in Japan.
It does exist, yeah.
To dealing with the needs of a graying population, and that's certainly the percentage of the population that's elderly is considerable and is expected to grow. And certainly there's a wide range of social issues in between. Is that something that the Japanese governments are going to have to spend more time thinking about?
Well, this really is probably the most pressing set of concerns that policymakers have, and also those in the private sector, all of society working together in the same way that we hear candidates in the contemporary campaign in the United States talking about needing to come to some new arrangements, building coalitions to make change, to deal with economic and social problems. In Japan, probably even more so, that the challenges are larger. 21% of Japanese are 65 and older now. It's one of the fastest graying, if not the fastest graying population in the world. And there's just no easy solution to this sort of thing. The social welfare system is not set up to deal with this. There aren't going to be enough young workers to respond to the needs of an aging population, and the other part of the aging population problem is the bigger percentage of Japanese are over 65 than in any other country, but also they live longer than anywhere else. Japanese are the longest lived people on the planet, so it's a very serious issue, and there's no real solution. And we're going to see social disruption in some way. No one knows how it's going to play out, but things are going to be different than they were in the early post-war, even the late 20th century. There's no question about that. I think that Japan is a dynamic society. There are many different voices. There are NGOs. There are all sorts of interest groups and organizations offering think tanks offering solutions in the same way that we would recognize here in the United States. And I do have confidence that there will be solutions that are at least fix the problem. Help the situation compared to today. I don't think there's any perfect long-term solution that will avoid social turmoil or social disruption it just seems like a very difficult task.
Is anybody talking seriously about actually opening up the country and changing their attitude towards outsiders and newcomers, encouraging people who are not Japanese to come live in Japan?
Yeah, well, I think this is going to be an issue that comes more and more to the fore. Again, that's been another long simmering kind of social debate, political debate. Japan, of course, a country that far more than other industrial democracies has focused or has organized its sense of national citizenship around an idea of racial citizenship. There has been some slight opening over the last 10 years, but it's nothing like what might have to happen if you really did need to take in new workers to support an aging population. I think this is not going to go away as a debate, and I think voices growing will be growing that are arguing that there's no other way around the problem than to allow more people to come in to take Japanese citizenship who aren't, you know, ethnically Japanese.
Yeah. Well, there we will have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Scott O'Brien. He is Assistant Professor of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.